Hello, my name is Tom Boone.
And I'm Joanna Bailey.
Welcome to a brand new episode of the Simple Flying Podcast, where we'll give you the lowdown on the latest news from the world of commercial aviation. Here's what we have for you this week.
Coming up today, I'll report on the final end of the road for Air India's Queens, while Tom tells us about a stored Airbus A330 destroyed by fire.
Joe will take a look at the latest situation with GPS jamming in Eastern Europe, while I look at Lufthansa's brand new business class product.
Finally, I'll explore what special flight authorization for Boom Supersonic actually means.
So now you know what's in store, let's get on with the show. And Joe, I want to give you the chance to open it this week.
Thank you, and sorry for my absence last week. I'm really glad to be back today. So one of the biggest stories of the week so far has been Air India's remaining Boeing 747 aircraft finally finding a new owner. So the airline's been trying to sell its last four Boeing 747-400s since the Tata takeover, which was January 2022. They worked with a UK-based firm called Skytech to market the jets, but it didn't seem like they were going to have any nibbles. However, the efforts have finally paid off, and they found a buyer in US-based broker and leasing firm AirSale. So all four of these aircraft are not young, clearly, being Boeing 747s and the 400 variant. They're actually over 25 years old, nearly as old as Tom, with two delivered in 1996, one in 1994, and one in 1993. According to people that are familiar with the matter, two of the airplanes may get a new life as converted freighters. The other two will be stripped down for parts. So over the years, Air India flew 31 747s, and it was one of the earliest adopters of the type. Their first 747-200 arrived in 1971, then they added the 300 in the 80s, and finally the 400s, which was, of course, the by far most popular variant of the type, was brought into the fleet in the 90s. You know, the jumbo jet is synonymous with India's golden age of air travel back in the day. It opened up many new routes for the carrier, added capacities to Air India's network, and had better fuel economy than previous generation planes. The carrier branded the upper deck as your palace in the sky, and it had amenities like lounges and bars and unique menus. They were even used as VVIP transport for the Prime Minister and President when they were on official visits. So, you know, like all good things, it must come to an end. And the use of the 747 at Air India was already in significant decline when the pandemic hit. And this health crisis only accelerated the retirement. All four have been parked up in Mumbai since 2021. But now one has flown again. Woohoo! So the first to depart the airport was VT-EVA, a 1996 vintage 747 named Agra. It had been stored in Mumbai, as we said, since March 2021, but it stretched its wings one final time as it left the airport for Roswell on April 22nd. The aircraft is rumoured to be parted out in Seattle's Payne Field, which is kind of a bittersweet twist in the tale, given that that was the very same airport where it once rolled off the production line. The pilots gave an impressive wing wave as the aircraft departed Mumbai. And of course, it was OMD, you know, those amazing plane ferry guys that we follow on Twitter. I'm sure everybody knows who I'm talking about.
I mean, I remember when the A380, the Lufthansa one, left Frankfurt for the final time when they didn't know if it was coming back. They did a wing wave of that, and it's if you ever get to see this, it's really cool.
It is cool. I saw Japan Airlines doing a wing wave with their first A350-1000, but I imagine with a giant quad jet, it's even better. So it did fly off to the US and, of course, closed the chapter of the Queen being with Air India. The other three could be flown out as well, almost definitely one of them will, or there are rumours that a couple could be parted out in situ. CH Aviation noted that the finalisation of the deal for the other three is still in the works, so it could be a little while before we see what's to become of the remaining Queens. But it was lovely to see a 747 in Air India colours flying again, even if it was only a ferry flight to the end of its life or potentially to becoming a freighter.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it was. I actually saw, I think it was the day after on Twitter, Thai Airways sort of said goodbye to its 747s as well. But they had like an event in a hangar, but this plane didn't even have engines on it.
Oh,
it was
no.
just the 747. it had like the bits where the engine would go, but no engine.
Oh.
It was quite...
Well,
quite
that one's not flying out of the airport with a wing wave, is it?
Yeah, no, I don't think it is. I don't think it is. But, you know, if you want to see a 747... piece of advice, come to Frankfurt. I don't have a good segue here. If I'd been talking about my next bit, I would have. But I wanted to talk because last week there was a fire that started in the tail of a retired Cathay Pacific Airbus A330-300. And it spread across the rest of the aircraft and left the fuselage completely destroyed. Now, this aircraft was parked at Ciudad Real International Airport in central Spain. And the local fire department in Castilla-La Mancha region and other authorities attended the blaze on April 18th. Multiple fire appliances attended this fire, and the aircraft airport fire crew, of course, were also there. But, you know, the fire was about midday, and the crew fought the flames for around 2.5 hours before the fire was officially extinguished. And, you know, at the moment, the cause of ignition remains unclear, and the aircraft itself has been totally destroyed. So... probably can't sell it for scrap now. It had initially been expected to be sold as scrap, but probably now it's just going to be swept away and put in the bin. As reported by our friend Sam Chewy, this is the first time that this Spanish airport has responded to such an incident. You know, they have fire drills every 6 months, and this aircraft used to be a commercial airport, used to be a commercial airport, but now it's, since 2011, has predominantly been used for aircraft maintenance, storage, and training. And it did even appear in Top Gear. So that seems to be quite a thing with retirement airports. I know Cotswolds is in there a lot. Is it? No, it's not Cotswolds.
Yeah, that was one of their racetracks for Wild, wasn't it? It was Kemble.
No, I think it's the other one where the other 747 went.
Oh, St. Athens?
No, it will come to me. I will look it up and find out. But anyway, you know, authorities are investigating the cause of the blaze. The preliminary report's probably going to come in the coming days. But thankfully, there were no casualties from this fire. It was nearly 30-year-old aircraft, so this one is old. Apparently, it's nearly 30 years old. It means 28 years old because it took flight in December 1995. So it's pretty much exactly as old as me. But, you know, it flew under the test registration Foxtrot Whiskey Whiskey Kilo Kilo and was delivered to Hong Kong-based carrier in January 2006. And it was initially registered as VRHLH before it changed to its current BHLH. According to CH Aviation, again, the aircraft could seat 24 passengers in business class, 10 in premium, and 293 at the back.
Not anymore, it can't.
No, maybe like five if you sweep it up tight, who knows. It was powered by two Rolls-Royce Trent 77260 engines and had the serial number 121. It's been stored since COVID-19 and hasn't flown in commercial service since September 2020. But... you know, this isn't the only time that we've seen a stored aircraft on fire in Spain, if you remember correctly.
I don't think I do. Let me fill you in then. Please do fill me in.
In November 2020, former British Airways Boeing 747 actually caught a light while being dismantled at Castellón Airport. In this case, it seemed as though while they were removing a window from the fuselage, a spark went off and ignited the insulation in the aircraft. And this produced a ton of black smoke as it burnt. The Castellón provincial firefighters attended the incident, and I think they brought the fire under control a lot quicker than this Cathay aircraft. They extinguished it completely. The aircraft had been significantly damaged, but a photo from the fire department shared on its Twitter back then, I call it Twitter because it was Twitter back then, shows that the aircraft's fuselage remained largely intact, and the only real damage was to the top of the aircraft. But the fun thing, they also shared a photo of the inside of the upper deck of this 747, and it was the Club World cabin, and you could see this from the seats that were still in there. maybe not so much fun for the people who used to operate it, because I did notice in the picture of the outside, they blurred out the very obvious British Airways logo.
Oh, dear.
But the damage to the fuselage was very apparent. There was a gaping hole in the ceiling, debris falling, but you could still recognize the seats, so it wasn't that bad. but... Yeah, that was a long time ago, 2020. So we've moved on a lot from there.
Let's hope that's the last of them. And I wonder, do you think the fire crews use satellite navigation to find their way to the airport when there's big events like this?
Oh, no. this is a really bad segue, I think. Really good, but really bad. But, I did see a reel on Instagram digressing where it was like how you think the firefighters drive to the airport, or not the airport, the scene, and like it was really high intense, and then how they really drive, and it was just like relaxing with like Party in the USA play or something.
So, oh dear, I'm not sure if firefighters will find that amusing or not.
Yeah, do they have satellite navigation systems? Tell me this.
Maybe so. I mean, I'm sure they do. Who doesn't use Waze or Google Maps to find their way around? But a few airlines are struggling to use their satellite navigation, also known as GPS systems, due to jamming incidents. So we've heard quite a bit over this over the last year or so. But there's been new research in the last few days that has shown just how many flights have been affected. So literally thousands of flights, particularly from the UK, have been targeted by suspected Russian GPS jamming, mostly near the Baltic region. Ryanair and Wizz Air logged thousands of problems, and a small number of British Airways, Jet2, EasyJet and TUI flights were also affected. So in the research, it said that in the 8 months up to the end of March, there were 2,309 reports by Ryanair, 1,368 by Wizz, and 82 by British Airways. So not an insignificant number of passenger flights being affected in just over half a year. And in fact, in March, one of the RAF planes that was carrying Defence Secretary Grant Shapps had its GPS signal jammed while flying near Russia. The satellite signal was interfered with for around 30 minutes while the flight was heading back to the UK from Poland. And then again, at the end of March, Russia was suspected of launching a 63-hour-long attack on GPS signals in the Baltic region. That started on Easter Sunday and went on for several days. And that one event affected about 1,600 aircraft. So, you know, it's not insignificant. The EU's aviation safety body, EASA, held a summit with IATA earlier this year to discuss jamming and spoofing. Both parties agreed that the attacks are worrying and do pose a safety risk, and that in the medium term, they plan to adapt the certification requirements of navigation and landing systems. Longer term, they want to be involved in the design of future satellite navigation systems in a bid to try and counter the risk. But it's not just Russia that's causing problems, because Israel too is indulging in GPS jamming. So over the last few months, since the start of the conflict in Gaza, multiple reports of GPS jamming around Israel's borders have been reported. Lebanon has protested Israel's use of GPS jamming, warning that it endangers civil aviation over the country. Beirut also intends to file a complaint to the United Nations over this interference. And, you know, Israel does focus its jamming on the south of the country, but this has already affected flights. In fact, one Turkish Airlines flight was forced to return back to Turkey after the interference prevented it from making a safe landing in Beirut. So GPS signals can be interfered with just by natural or uncontrollable events, such as solar storms, for example. But wanton GPS jamming is much more serious. It usually involves flooding the GPS receivers with unknown signals to make the receiver unusable. And that essentially degrades everyone's ability, not just planes, but people on the ground as well, to effectively use GPS to navigate. Also of concern are the ongoing GPS spoofing attacks, where a lookalike signal is transmitted that puts aircraft at an incorrect time or incorrect place. But to put everyone's mind at rest, you know, it's not dangerous to fly to the east of Europe at the moment, because airliners and their crews, they're very aware of GPS jamming and spoofing, and they're trained to use backup instrumentation when it happens. That means they can still fly, they can still land, they can still operate and safely complete their flights, but they have to rely on some of the old tech rather than the advanced satellite navigation that they used to. So I'll be glad when it all comes to an end anyway.
Yeah, well, I mean, just on that, you know, I remember when I was in Brussels in March for the annual A4E conference, Carsten Spohr of Lufthansa CEO Notoriety was asked about this problem, and because he was a pilot before he became CEO of Lufthansa, and he said, you know, like, pilots aren't taught to, like, follow the GPS, you know, like, I remember when I was taught to fly, you know, We were always taught how to use all of the instruments to fly and not just rely on this purple line going forwards. And now, you know, now I know why we were told this, you know. So, yeah, you know, like, from a point of view of the pilots, you know, it's not the end of the world. They're trained to how to fly without a GPS. But, you know, it would just make life a lot easier if it didn't happen.
Definitely.
But talking of Lufthansa, I wanted to now talk a little bit about Allegris. If you're not sure what Allegris means, this is the Lufthansa business class product that we've been patiently waiting for quite a while. I'm not sure exactly how long, but now it's finally here. It's finally here, Joe. It's like actually on an aircraft. And Simple Flying is going to obviously see it in the flesh later on an aircraft this week. And I'm sure I will talk more about it next week on the podcast. But as we record this, you know, tomorrow I'm flying down to Munich and then we're going to go to the Lufthansa hangar and get to walk on the aircraft, try out the seats and take plenty of photographs. I might even take my measuring tape. Who knows? But the excitement doesn't stop there. And I'm going to talk about it more next week. But I thought this week, let's set the scene by diving in a little bit deeper about what we really know about Allegris so far. So Allegris is actually, it's a whole new cabin for Lufthansa's long-haul aircraft. Most people are just fixating on first and business class, but we're also going to see economy improvements in economy and premium economy. With the rollout of Allegris, Lufthansa's set to be introducing something like a comfort version of economy, with passengers being allowed to book a seat towards the front of the cabin just behind the premium economy, and they're going to get more leg room, some other nice little bits here. You may already have experienced newish premium economy seats on the Swiss fleet over the last couple of years. They're going to make their way into the new Allegris cabin, but you know, you want to know about business class, don't you?
Of course.
So let's talk about business then, because that's where the most interest is. And the fascinating thing about this cabin is just how diverse it is. I think Lufthansa is really doing something different here. I think the change that Lufthansa is driving in the business cabin could be described as like the change that Qatar used when it brought in the Q suites. You know, this is going to be a real substantial change. And I'm still like on the fence about whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, how it's going to work exactly. Because by my reckoning, each business class cabin is going to have up to 8 different seats in the the business class config. You know, you've got suites at the front of the cabin, you've got throne seats in the middle, you've got extra privacy seats. You haven't got Jeff, sadly, though. So.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. I think my favorite seat, you know, is definitely the throne. Although this is me talking having not seen the seats, you know, like maybe having seen them tomorrow, I'll be like, oh no, don't go for the throne, go for this. Right now, I would say my favorite is the throne. And I do hope that if I do get to fly on it at this point in time, I would be in that seat, but let's talk next week and I'll tell you if I would still say that. So the aircraft that we're going to see is registered as Delta Alpha India X-Ray Tango, and it was ferried from Toulouse-Blagnac Airport to Munich Airport on April 13th. So it's already been there for about 10 days, just chilling. It's configured with 4 first-class seats, 38 business-class, 24 premium economy, and 201 economy seats. However, the first-class cabin isn't going to be initially available because I understand they're still pending some additional certifications from EASA or someone.
Are you going to be allowed to see it, though, at least?
I don't know. I don't know if, like, I really don't know at this point if it's there and it's just going to be like, you can't sit here yet, or if they've just left the space empty for now to put it in later. Who knows? I can tell you that next week. But, you know, in March, Lufthansa announced the first destination for the Allegris cabin would be Vancouver International Airport. And the new cabin is going to launch on May 1st. Lufthansa said, Lufthansa Allegris redefines what it means to fly, offering unparalleled comfort, service, and much more. Prepare to be elevated from the moment you step on board, starting in May 2024, from Muck to YVR. So, yeah, it's going to be initially not on every flight between Munich and Vancouver, because with one aircraft, that gets a bit tricky. You've got to take it out of service for cleaning it, maintenance, etc. Maybe the schedules don't align. I have noticed that Lufthansa puts a lovely big banner on the booking engine. If you've got Allegris, you will know it. It says this is an Allegris flight.
Nice.
For the time being, they are allowing people to pick their own seat for free in the business cabin, but I'm under the understanding that at some point, you know, you'll have to pay, and maybe for this seat, you might have to pay 500 euros, whereas that seat would only be 300 euros, because it's a different kind of seat, you know, it's not so private, maybe, or you don't get so much space. But, you know, watch this space. I'm sure I will have a lot more to say in a week time.
I'm excited to hear what it looks like. And we have been waiting an awfully long time for that. Something we're also waiting an awfully long time for, and we'll continue to do so, is the return of supersonic commercial passenger flight. So it has had a bit of a step forward this week, because Boom Supersonic, who of course is leading the race for new supersonic commercial flights with its Overture, has received FAA clearance to break the sound barrier with its experimental flight test demonstrator known as XB1. So the special flight authorization was awarded on April the 16th and basically gives the company permission to exceed Max 1 with the XB1 and another chase aircraft. So the FAA has to conduct an environmental assessment for any special flight authorizations, particularly in this case, because the impact of a sonic boom over land has to be evaluated. That was traditionally something Concorde was not allowed to do, so it always waited until it was out over water to go to Mach 1. But the XB1 doesn't have capacity for overwater flights, so it's going to have to be tested over land. In all, Boom has authorization for 20 flights, which it says... I want to start that bit again. In all, Boom Supersonic has authorization for 20 flights, which it says it will conduct in the historic Black Mountain Supersonic Corridor and a portion of the High Altitude Supersonic Corridor. This is an area that's been used extensively for research and military supersonic operations. Testing there includes the Bell X-1, the first X-plane that breached the sound barrier, as well as the X-15, which set records for height and speed, and the Lockheed SR-71 Blackbird, definitely iconic plane there. This has helped Boom get its SFA locked down, as the FAA environmental assessment noted that although the Boom technology test events would be expected to generate additional sonic boom noise, the noise increase would not be significant given the Department of Defense's long history of supersonic test flights in this area. So of course, the XB1 is going to continue flight testing at subsonic speeds first. It's already had its first flight, but it's going to continue doing more of those, making sure all in-flight systems are functioning as planned. Once it's complete that little campaign, supersonic flight tests will begin. During the supersonic flight tests, XB1 will be basically a flying data collector. It's already got a massive data acquisition system integrated into the aircraft. This data will be reviewed by engineers and will serve to refine and validate calculations and processes that will feed into the development of the Overture. So the test aircraft will be taking off from Mojave Air and Spaceport, and it will be taken up to 30,000 feet. I do too, before it attempts to break Mach 1. Test pilot Tristan Gepetto Brandenburg, who's a former US Navy test pilot, and he also flew the chase plane during XB1's first flight, he said, "Right now the plan is to have multiple supersonic flights. We plan to do Mach 1.1, Mach 1.2, and 1.3 on the first three flights. The reason for this is that each one of those points takes so much airspace that you only have time to do one at a time." Makes sense, I suppose. If you're going that fast, you're going to run out of space pretty quickly and have to go home and refuel. But according to the company, the first Mach 1.1 flight, which will be flown by Tristan, will be completed before the end of this year. Of course, this is still a long way from having Overture on offer for passengers. The XB1 is a vehicle for learning about supersonic flight, allowing Boom to gain the skills to successfully launch the Overture. Blake Scholl, who's their CEO, described it as a technical proof of concept in a learning vehicle. He added that we built this airplane to learn, to discover what we didn't know, to discover what it really takes to build a civil supersonic airplane, one that's safe enough to be flown by a human. I mean, you know, I'm all for having humans fly planes as opposed to, what, chimpanzees? Or AI,
maybe,
I guess.
Yeah, AI, computers.
I do think it's great that they're progressing. And, you know, I know there's a lot of naysayers in the industry that don't think we'll ever set foot on the Overture, but I'm keenly following it. I like to dream. London to New York in a couple of hours. I mean, who wouldn't want it?
Who knows? Maybe Montreal.
Definitely. Well, I think that's all we've got time for on today's podcast. We hope you enjoyed it and welcome your feedback at editorial@simpleflying.com.
For more great content, you can visit our website at simpleflying.com or find us on social media. Simply search for Simple Flying.
If you enjoyed the podcast, please do leave us a rating on your favourite podcast player. Thanks for listening.
Bye.